Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. We keep learning, In the studio with me today, my friend and sometimes co-host, Jeremy Spiegel. Hey there, Jeremy.
Hello, Armand.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
But primarily, our guest today, I like that. That was a nice little slip. Our gift today is Deborah King. Deborah King. You know, there are certain people who, when they do certain things, they just cross the right path, and I like where they step. And Deborah steps in a place that I really admire. This is about a kind of mind-body healing, but it's based on a book that Deborah just put out, and let's introduce it. Deborah, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you for having me here.
I know we're going to talk about this connection. Can you tell me about lying? Tell me about the big lie, because this is really impressive. Because it's really, I haven't heard anybody say it as strongly, but you're great. Deborah goes out there and she points her finger at you and she says, "You're a liar," and heals you by saying it. I love it. Go ahead.
Well, I wouldn't say I use those exact words, but that's the process. Actually, we all tell ourselves lies constantly, and it's those lies. It's not the lies we tell other people. It's the lies we tell ourselves that really hurt us. They make us sick. And what I help people do is find out where they're kidding themselves and start unraveling that process.
What kind of lies do people tell themselves?
Oh, we tell ourselves lies about our relationships. We'll say, "I got over that divorce years ago," and we haven't. You know, we're just holding on to all that resentment and pain. Or maybe we kid ourselves about our job. We say, "You know, I spent years becoming an accountant. I love my job," when deep in our heart, we know we hate it. Those are the kind of lies I'm talking about.
And lies in relationships that are current. You talk about past, current relationships. There are so many people out there who live in a silent despair, and they kind of almost have disdain for each other. But they say, "We have a good marriage."
They do, and they say to themselves, you know, it's a quid pro quo. They have this arrangement, or they have an agreement, or they have a deal. I get this, you get that, and we endure it.
When you uncover these lies, or when you look at these lies that people live, how do these, according to your eyes, how do they manifest? I mean, what is the consequences of lying to yourself, which means blinding yourself to the truth of what's really happening for you, right? That's what the lie is?
That's exactly what it means.
I mean, it's not intentional. It's like you could do it intentionally, but it mostly becomes unconscious lying.
It's mostly unconscious, and we learn to do it when we're pretty young.
When you lie, what happens?
Well,
I mean, how does it manifest?
Well, it manifests first by stopping the energy at some place in your body, because to live an untruth, you have to store the truth somewhere deep down. And that requires a lot of energy to hold on to that emotion or that feeling and not let it come out. It can require as much as 2/3 of your energy to live a lie. And that's a lot of physical energy that you could be using to stay healthy. And instead, it's a spiral down.
You believe that a person can have, by segmenting the truth, hiding the truth, they put the truth in little pockets inside themselves. And from what I've seen in your book, and just to let you know, an endorsement by Christian Northrup and Jack Canfield as well, you're saying, you know, this is going to hit your body. And maybe a lot of illness is going to appear as a result of your hidden lies. So so Freud's theory of having it appear in the body is you're saying, sure, that's the way it happens.
That is the way it happened. And I learned it not academically. I learned it in my own experience with my own body.
You had to find out your own lie because you had an illness.
Right.
What was your illness?
Well, I had three or four preliminary illnesses, and this is what happens to other people, too. They'll start with something small, like maybe a headache. My experience, I was in my teens, and I think my first experience was with, I have to think way back, an eating disorder, I think was where I started as a young teenager. And then the next thing I knew, I had...
Fat or skinny eating disorder?
A skinny eating disorder.
Thank you very much.
I just didn't eat.
I like my categorization. This is the clinical self-speaking.
Yeah.
Do you
have
a fat disorder or a skinny disorder?
No, I found that if I lived on eggs and grapes, that I would be always a size 2. And
okay.
That seemed highly desirable at the time.
Is that really a secret? I might try it.
Okay.
Yes, but of course, that's hiding a truth. Now, back then, here you are a young, young woman who is anorexic and keeping herself really in an eating disorder. And you say back there was the truth that had you faced that truth, you wouldn't have had that problem. Is that true?
If I could have acknowledged what I was really trying to get by not eating.
What were you trying to get?
Approval from men, male approval. And the way to do that was to be, as shapely as possible.
Shapely or shapeless?
Well, let's say not overshaped.
So the problem was that you perceived that if you had too much weight on your body, if you had fat of any kind, you would not be loved.
Exactly. And that's what it's all about.
Okay,
every
where
lie
it all goes back to.
Every lie boils down to needing love. It's twisted, of course. But the lies we tell other people, it's the same thing. We're trying to get or keep their love.
Very interesting. Very interesting stuff so far. Jeremy?
Yeah, that's fascinating. So you, by uncovering the truth to yourself, you heal yourself.
Exactly. I've seen it happen with thousands of people.
What was the second manifestation of your illness?
Oh, my own personal experience. I went from an eating disorder to being bipolar. Back in those days, it was more commonly called manic depressive.
And you mean the real heavy manic depressive stuff?
The full-blown variety, yeah.
Full-blown?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, started...
Like cyclothymia, going around there.
Yeah.
And you would go from being very, very elated and manic and...
And very thin.
And very thin.
And very happy,
mm-hmm.
or so I thought, to being very lethargic, slept 18, 20 hours a day, gained 20, 30 pounds, just literally was so slowed down I couldn't drive because I couldn't respond fast enough at a streetlight.
Wow. So now that must have driven you. Did that drive you to treatment? Did that say... Somebody help me.
I went to a psychiatrist and was promptly put
lithiumed
on
lithium or something, right?
Right.
And he gave you lithium, and now this kind of helped balance you somewhat.
A little bit,
mm-hmm. And you were able to think yourself straight. But what was the real bottom line of what was going on?
What if
he was a real good shrink? Might he have done other than give you medication?
He never got to the bottom.
Right. What if he said, let's look at your bottom, which, pardon the expression. What if he said, let's look at what's underneath this?
He didn't. And, I gave him plenty of clues. So I reflect back today and I wonder why he didn't pick up on it.
Because a lot of them, once they have the pill, once they're on the pill, they forget about everything. That's why Jeremy, he's a psychiatrist. And he thinks. It's a remarkable thing. I love him. Jeremy, there's so few. But once you get a psychiatrist who's got the pills, they stop thinking. So he gave you your pill and he stopped thinking, but what did you know? If you were your therapist back then, what would you have done? You would have said, come on, wake up, you're lying to yourself.
I would have helped that person get in touch with their emotions. We never did that, not in his office.
Now, are you? I have a question, if I may. Now, did you? He diagnosed you bipolar.
Uh huh.
And are you still manifesting symptoms?
No, no, and haven't in many, many, many years.
And you take no medication.
No.
Now, it could well be that he maybe didn't get the diagnosis right.
Oh, I think he had the diagnosis right, and it there's a lot of it in my family, which I, of course, didn't know at that time because my parents didn't want me to know about it. I'm sure they saw it as a black stain on their normalcy, so it was never talked about.
When you talk about get to your emotions, you know, all the shrinks like to talk about feelings. They like to talk about them. You said get to them. You mean feel them.
Yes.
You mean
I mean process them.
Process them.
Yeah.
And that would mean he'd have to have a soundproof office.
Right. Right.
Which most shrinks don't have.
Uh-huh.
So most therapists don't have soundproof offices. So if you raise your voice, they get worried about it, whether the neighbor's going to hear it. It gets kind of funny. They say go into your emotions, but please don't go in too deeply.
And that's what in the work I've been doing for the last 25 years, that's where I started, and that's what I was trained to do, was help people process their emotions, and you needed a soundproof office.
And what kind of training did you have to go there?
But let me just continue on for a minute, because today the work I do, that's not necessary. I've through a lot of trial and error and a lot of people, I've figured out a way to help people move through their emotions, and I no longer need the soundproofing because it happens very quickly.
People can get that through. You're going to tell us how, and they'll also get the book Truth Heals, What You Hide Can Hurt You by Deborah King, which is what we're talking about. All right, let's talk about the original process now. When you were going through original process of emotions, were you taking people into cathartic emotional states, like primal states and deep, deep states to uncover the emotions?
Yes.
Were doing that, right? Where did you learn that?
I learned that in two different, entirely different arenas. One was with a shaman, and one was here in the U.S. in what they call sort of standard energy medicine, energy training, what is often called the Barbara Brennan work.
Right, the release.
Which was actually, I think, brought out by one of the people you worked with earlier.
Sure. And so now that kind of, you got that and you said, look at this freedom. If I could get a person to acknowledge their emotions that they're hiding from themselves, the lie that they're telling themselves, if I could anyway see a manifestation in their body, they're sick. If I could get them to face that truth by feeling the feeling or something else going through that feeling, they're going to release the amount of energy that is invested in holding on to it through an illness.
Exactly, but it's not a conscious procedure. They don't have to be conscious of it at all.
Right. Now, let me ask you your third. What was your third illness besides manic depression?
When I was 25, I had cancer.
Oh, my God almighty. Don't they leave you alone? You're a nice kid, right? You're a nice kid. You just got rough background, cancer, manic depression, and skinny. Rough stuff. Rough stuff. You were dealt a deal.
Well, I also had, at that point, I had to acknowledge. At that point, I stopped, and I went, you know what? I've been kidding myself. I thought I was healthy and happy, and healthy and happy can't breed this many problems. This doesn't compute. So
I've seen enough healthy people who fall over dead from hidden truth.
So I looked back, and I had to stop and realize that I had an addiction to alcohol at that point. Mm. I was addicted to Valium. Mm. I had a lot of coping mechanisms. So what was I coping with?
Right. You know? So enough science to say, you know, if I was really so okay, I wouldn't be drinking or taking Valium. There's something I'm afraid of, and I'm keeping myself calm because I'm afraid of getting nervous, and I'm drinking to try to control some energy state. And here I am. My body's in rebellion, and the cancer. What kind of cancer was it?
Cervical.
Cervical cancer, which is why this is where Christiane comes in. Right? Christian Northrop came in through that exploration?
Oh, no. This was many, many years ago.
Okay. And then you get that. Now, what did you get? Did you get, like, a dysplasia? Or was it, like, a full cancer diagnosis?
It was dysplasia at first, and then it developed into a full diagnosis.
And you went into this, and you went into the emotions behind it. What were you denying yourself? Besides the fact that you needed love, what was kind of hiding behind that door?
Well, I wasn't wanting to face the realities of my childhood. I mean, I was conscious of them. It's just I didn't sit around and think about them all the time. I thought my childhood was probably pretty similar to others. Everybody's had some roughness. Mm-hmm. Mine had been maybe a little rougher than that.
What? How rough?
Well, I'd been sexually abused twice. By two different people. One was a family member, and one was the priest at the school I attended.
Mm. Those will really help your trust buttons. You know, we were talking to someone who has a multiple personality disorder, and we were talking about obsessive compulsive disorders just earlier. And we keep coming down to the trust button. You know, where and when do we shut off our trust? Because when we shut off our trust is when we start to lie to ourselves. When we say, I can trust nobody else except myself, that's when we have to hide our truth in a corner somewhere. And so when working with people, you know, it's so hard when you're working with therapists who, you know, are trying different things on you. So here you are now, cervical cancer, right? Cervical cancer, and you're, what are you going to do about it? What are you, how
well,
are you
I'll tell you what
about?
I did. I thought about the surgery that was recommended at the time. And, of course, it's different now. It's 25 years later. But then it was pretty invasive and fairly radical. And I went out and got a massage, which strikes you as kind of an unusual. I remember walking down the street and thinking, what do I do now? And I saw this massage sign, and I went in, and I made an appointment with this gal. And about halfway into the massage, she taps me and says, have you ever had energy work? And I said, no, what is it? She said, well, I just think it'd be something that'd be really good for you. Are you open to it? And I said, sure. And whatever she did, it's as if something opened. Because I really went home and I realized I felt different. I went back a couple of days later and had a second session with her. And then everything just started to open.
Hands-on energy work?
It was hands-on.
Hands-on, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Did she sense that something was wrong with this? Did she sense the cervical cancer, or did you tell her?
I don't recall.
Because I remember Barbara Brennan working on a friend of mine with a similar kind of thing. And she put her hands on her body, and I was watching. And I saw this thing take place that just rocked me. You know, it was like an amazing thing, the eruption of the inside that comes out.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that happened. But then I've seen a whole bunch of other energy healers who are just do nothing. You know,
well, I went from that gal. She referred me after I'd seen her about four or five times over a space of a month, perhaps. She said to me, I think you need some additional help. And she referred me to someone else. And when I went to the next person, I had really an amazing remission. I mean, right on her table. It was pretty incredible. And I was like, what is this stuff? And I started searching at that point, and I would spend a year or two with some trainer or healer or shaman, and then when I had exhausted what they knew, I would move on to another. I did that for many, many years. At one point, I finally left my job as an attorney, and I went into just full bore into this very mysterious world of healers, sages, and shamans, where I've stayed.
Yeah. So now you've taken this stuff you've learned about yourself, heart or lung disease, diabetes, cancers of all kinds, and you've learned that there's a way to get to people that's a shortcut that you have for getting people to uncover the lie about themselves that they're telling themselves that may be manifesting in some kind of an illness, right?
Right.
So could you tell me about the process?
Well, it's taken me 25 years to figure out how to do that, because at first it was very slow. I spent the first more than 5 years with an esoteric Christian group that practiced a form of long-distance healing, and I learned a really amazing amount there. And then from there I went into more Western-oriented energy work and spent years in that arena, both as a student and as a teacher. And, you know, it was always an hour, and you'd barely scrape the surface. You might just get, 1% improvement with someone. It was like watching cement harden. It was very, very slow. And then about 10 years ago, I discovered that if I was working with a person in a public setting, that I could effectuate change much more quickly and much more deeply. A much more profound change, sometimes at the cellular level. And so then I became really intrigued. I thought, how is this happening? How is change being affected in this person, in their body, at the cellular level? And I can't say that I know the answer, but I know how to produce
it. Wait a minute now. So are you doing hands-on healing at this point when you're working with people? You're doing hands-on healing, energy transfer, evoking emotions at this time?
Probably at one level. I'm probably doing three or four things at once.
Pardon my shortcut language. I like shortcut, fat or skinny. I like this. Hands-on energy healing, focused attention, spiritual transfer, the whole shebang.
Yeah, especially the focused attention.
The focused attention. Mm-hmm. Now, there we go. Now, you see, now we get back to trust.
Yeah.
Person feels focused attention like that coming in their direction, all kinds of doors open. Now the door creaks open and they say, okay, I trust you. And now you've got to have a tool to go in there and clean up the junk.
Yeah, what really makes them feel that sense of trust is the unconditional love.
What we call unconditional love, which means full attention, your full regard for them.
Right.
Right?
Right. With no judgment. With no judgment with where they are today. Just that full sense of their humanness and their divinity. It's all encompassed in one.
Do you think people can do that for themselves? Do you think people can get that unconditional regard for themselves and heal themselves? Or do you think it requires an outside person or a book?
At this point, I have to say I think it requires something from the outside. I'm hoping to get to that level where I can figure out how to accomplish that for people and then give them that tool.
Okay,
don't think I'm there yet.
Okay, so now we have the door open. By the way, people who just tuned in, my guest is Deborah King in the studio with me. Helping out is my my friend Jeremy Spiegel, Dr. Jeremy Spiegel. We're here talking with Deborah King about The Truth Heals, and we're going to be talking about this on two different levels. Right now, we are investigating the process of the way that people can possibly get some kind of remission or cure or relief from some of the physical conditions that people manifest as a result of people just deluding themselves, hiding from themselves, not wanting to face the truth. And Deborah's leading us into a path. Now, you say something about public. I'm fascinated. Public rather than private. You mean you got to take it outdoors? What do you mean?
You know, I do mean that.
I
don't work outdoors because there's no limit to where the energy can go.
Yeah.
But what I've discovered, and it was by happenstance, is that the more people that are in the room, the faster the process is.
Wow.
So obviously there is something there about the way that we join with others. There's some combined energy. There's an effect. I can't quantify it.
I know, but there's something that takes place. Obviously, you know, the Native Americans have known it for years when they do sweat lodges.
Right.
Right? In a sweat lodge, you have combined energy. You know, they've taken... I know someone who's out on the West Coast who might know Dr. Cherry Quincy, who she helps people through sweat lodges, especially when they have heavy PMS. If they have heavy premenstrual syndrome, she goes into a sweat lodge where the women are all together, and it disappears.
Hmm.
What is it? What is being transmitted? What is happening? Is it words? Is it all that love from the rest of the group? Something does happen in a group process, and I think group process is very valuable. So now, if people are trying to do this, do they need you're saying the fast way is through a group process. But is there anything they could do if they don't have a group available, if our people listening?
Well, that's actually why I wrote Truth Heals, because at that point I had been crossing the country back and forth working with people in live events for a number of years. And it dawned on me I wasn't going to be able to see everybody. So I thought, well, I'll write a book, and in it I'll try to connect the dots for people between what's going on in their body and these emotions that perhaps they've lost, just like I had lost mine. They, you know, they can't quite figure out what it is that's making them sick. And so Truth Heals really does illuminate for people, you know, maybe 80% of their problem.
So give me an example of how you do it. Give me an example of the steps.
Well, I'll just give you Bill Clinton as an example. He's sort of a classic. Here's a guy who was real healthy up to a point, and the next thing you know, he's having open heart surgery, and he says, oh, it's the fast food that did me in. Well, I don't think so. I think actually what happened to him was he lost the love of the country. It broke his heart. Hmm. And I use a lot of celebrity examples for the reader because that's what we all tune into now.
Give
that's
me an
what
example
we relate
of some
to.
Of those
Melissa Etheridge and her breast cancer, for example, or Larry King and his heart attack. Just that people can look at the celeb and go, oh, I understand. I do that. Or that's what my brother's doing. You know, it just helps them connect.
Deborah, if I understand correctly, you're suggesting that the emotions cause the disorder?
Actually, what happens is the emotions cause a stagnation or a blockage of our normal dynamic flow of energy in and out, not just in and out of our body, but as you know, we have an energy field that surrounds our body. Even modern physics has agreed to this. And when we block our emotions, it stops the natural flow. And anytime you stop the flow, you're going to get stagnation. And from stagnation, you get illness.
So in other words, it could be that there are many factors that go into somebody's event, whether it's a cardiac arrest or whatnot. The healing from it will happen either faster or slower based on what you're describing.
Well, you've made an important point, which is, of course, I'm oversimplifying to help people understand, but there are always a number of things that tie into, you know, any single disease state. There's rarely just one cause.
And we're talking with Deborah King. Okay, Deborah, so now you've got a very fascinating image that I like very much. So here we have this energy flow that's kind of going through us, and we in our human innocence and beauty and what toll it would take as you're trying to be political, which means lying.
It means not true. That's, yeah, just the word political
means not true, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah. Therefore, now you turn around to people who are doing something like killing people, and you say, I'd like to talk to you about killing them. Could you maybe not kill them so much, you know, and have to do it in a way that holds you back?
Uh-huh.
Now, the minute you hold you back,
you're holding back a part of your truth.
And therefore, you're getting that stagnation.
What I've discovered is that, and this isn't just my work, this is built on, you know, a lot of other people's work, is that certain illnesses key to certain points of the body where we're inclined to stop the flow of energy. So it's not a coincidence, for example, if you stifle your expression through your throat, that putting all that pressure on your throat all those years, you're very likely to end up with thyroid problems. Just as it's no coincidence that thyroid disorders in the U.S. are 5-1 women to men, because, you know, women are much more inclined to be swallowing their words.
You know, we're going to continue with this. We have to take a short break. This is Armand DeMille. We're on WBAI 99.5. We will be back with you in a couple of minutes. My friends, stay tuned for the truth. I'll be right back.
Saint-Honoré, j'ai cherché ça et là, je ne l'ai pas trouvé. Dis-moi, où est ma tête? J'ai perdu mes bras sur la place de l'Opéra, je ne les ai pas trouvés. J'ai cherché ça et là, dis-moi, où sont J'ai cherché ça et là, je ne l'ai pas trouvé. Dis-moi, où est mon nez? Reviens, chérie, fais-moi. Mon nez n'importe pas. C'est toi qui peux me compléter. Thank you.
And this is Armand DeMille back with you with Deborah King, talking about how hiding the truth from yourself can manifest in physical disturbances from the book, from the radio program that Deborah King does called Truth Heals, from the website truthheals.com. And this is about lying to yourself. We don't believe people. It says we don't believe our leaders, the people in the news, the CEOs, the CFOs. We don't believe our financial advisors anymore. We don't believe a lot. We even lie to ourselves. Now, what are all of the effects of this lying? And this is what Deborah's talking about. So, Deborah, how do you become your own personal lie detector? How do you do that?
Oh, that's a fun one. Actually, it's built into our bodies. We're just not, in our culture, we're not that conscious of it, but it's a really easy thing to develop because every single person has this equipment. So, you know, for you, it might be your gut instinct that speaks to you. And if you ignore it, it'll quit sending you information. But if you just tune into it and honor it, if it says, hey, this person doesn't feel right or this situation doesn't feel right, if you honor that information, just it's like a muscle. The more you use it, the stronger it gets.
But, you know, there's a problem here. What if you're paranoid? What if you're paranoid and you always listen to the, hey, watch out, watch out, watch outs?
Well, see, you're talking about something that's coming from your head, and I'm talking about an actual physical manifestation that's coming from your gut.
Paranoid people can feel it in their guts because your gut's going to respond as well. The very paranoia is the lie. They're lying to mm-hmm. themselves that they're not safe, and that's the lie right there. A further lie with paranoia, this is one I think you're going to love, Jeremy. One of the things about being paranoid is that it makes you important. Because once you're paranoid, you believe everybody wants to hurt you. And therefore, it means at least somebody's noticing you. It means, therefore, you're not invisible. It means somebody, even though they hate you, at least is paying attention to you. So one way of becoming important is to be paranoid. Isn't that cute? But one of the things that happen is when you're lying to yourself at that level, how do you tell? I mean, how do you tell? Because you got an upset stomach. How do you tell? How do you tell most people?
Well, you know, that's a very difficult one. And what I'm talking about, I think, was more the garden variety kind of feelings that your average Joe gets from his gut.
Okay. And the average Joe gets from his gut is this doesn't smell right.
Right.
Right? Yeah, I have one called Too Good to Be True, too, which is whenever anybody presents anything or I see anything, it's absolutely perfect. Some part of me says, you know, it's probably going to be a little disappointment because it probably, and I like to ignore that. And then, you know, watch the disappointment appear a little later and I go, I wish I had listened. What are the other signs that people have? How do you become your own lie detector? What else do you have?
Well, it varies with each person's body. You know, you might get goosebumps that might mean something special to you, or someone else might get butterflies in their stomach. Some people just have an intuitive sense of what's right for them, or, you know, or this isn't the right apartment when they're out apartment hunting.
You know, I wonder if somebody were to videotape themselves and they watch them, a la your other example with Bill Clinton, the number of eye blinks during that terrible time in his presidency was an indicator, and people study the number of blinks. And it's correlated with the person maybe talking untruths or prevaricating is the technical term. You know, I wonder about that.
Well, Jeremy, it's kind of interesting you mentioned that. My teacher, one of my early teachers, was Peter Hogan. And we used to do a thing in family therapy called where he would have couples, and we have a man here now who works with me who does this, record on video the couple as they're talking to each other. Mm-hmm. And then he'll have them recorded talking to each other. Then he will play back one or the other and say, what were you really saying here? And your face will tell a different story. So your perception there is accurate because it does seem to be very valuable. Because when you watch yourself in playback, you wonder. You go, ooh.
Mm. Well, you wonder if you can teach somebody who, let's say, does not have the fingertip feeling for when they are lying to themselves. but you maybe begin the process by something external that they could, something concrete that they can kind of sink their teeth into, and then you bring them from there down to the more esoteric, the more abstract, even though, granted, you're talking about physical twinges and whatnot, but
That's all very, very interesting. And if you've thought about, it's so easy with other people. We've watched Governor Blagojevich lie straight, looking at the camera, unblinking, big smile, and also Ted Haggard's been on quite a bit, and it's been very interesting to watch them both because they're okay when they're focused in the camera. They're fairly practiced at what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But watch them when they believe the camera, there's a clip running and they're not aware there's a split screen. And so they're not aware the camera's on them. They're thinking that the camera's only on the clip. It's very interesting to see the look because it's very different. It's not that confident, I know my material kind of a lie look.
Not that practiced. I know my material, and practiced enough to know that there's always a camera watching. You know, the more of a pro you become, the more you say, you know, you never make it. Don't slip yourself a cigarette outdoors because somebody's going to be watching. All right. So the signs of deception would be your body breaking down. What else would they be?
Are you talking about yourself when you're lying?
Yeah, when you're lying.
It starts off with a feeling of unhappiness, of not feeling balanced, of not feeling like things are right. And then it descends from there, you know, into little symptoms of, you know, a little stomach disorder or a little headache. It progresses differently for each person, of course.
Suffering is a kind of an interesting symptom because you said it's like a sadness. But one of the things that I find also is blaming. When you're lying to yourself, one of the things you do is you try to blame somebody else for what's going on. And that is, I think, one of the biggest signs, but one of the hardest signs to break through. When a person says, it's because my husband doesn't love me enough. It's because, you know, my boss, so on and so forth. Do you find that?
Of course. Yeah.
So blaming is one sign, and then unhappiness is another sign. Then physical manifestations.
Any kind of coping mechanisms. I mean, you have to
alcohol,
ask people.
Drugs,
sure.
Why food. Are you?
What's the problem there? What's that really saying?
Yeah. I often wonder, you know, when we go through physicals or we go to our holistic healers, and many of us do, you go to holistic healers. Somewhere along the line, the holistic healer should be saying, and what lies do you say to yourself? Just a little, maybe even a questionnaire, you know? What lie do you have for yourself? Because I think once you get to ask a person who's going through, they're telling you about their bowels and their history and everything else, and what's bothering you? What lies are you living? Seems to be a vital question in the healing, in the importance of
it. It isn't, but I wonder how hard it is for people to answer that question, because, of course, that's not a question I ever ask anyone.
You never ask the question?
I never ask it because I already know the answer. So my job is to help them find that information themselves without ever volunteering it.
They probably wouldn't be at the doctor's office if they had asked themselves that question.
That's right.
You know what I mean? In the first place, it probably wouldn't even get you there. The other signs that you have of this kind of self-deception, of physical manifestation of illness now, right? I mean, we have that. Do you bother to trace the physical manifestation of the illness to its historical sense? Do you go back in time as to when did this first appear? When did other things like this appear? Or how far back does that lie go? Like if you're lying to yourself about, you know, I'm unhappy in my marriage.
No, I don't usually. Because, see, I usually only have, I'm working in a public setting. There are, say, a couple hundred people in the room, and I will work with a volunteer for less than 3 or 4 minutes. And so there isn't a lot of, I don't need much time. And I just get a sense of it.
And what happens? Then you use the group power is what I see you do.
Well, I think there's some support from the group for sure, but there's also something, some other dynamic that I can't quite put my finger on. But from my training, what I'll do is I'll find the key point that will help unravel the physical blockage the fastest. And it might not be where it originated. It might just be the key point for today. So maybe their problems originated. Maybe I'm dealing with a woman who's had a lot of problems that originate in her pelvic area, but the key point for her today might be in her throat, and that may be where it unravels the fastest.
So if we were to ask our audience to take a look right now and ask themselves the questions, because they get a chance, because these are people who are listening to us, and we would say, we would ask, what are you lying to yourself about now?
Well, I'll tell you the easy way to do it, Armand, is if they just go to truthheals.com. I have a free quiz posted on the website. It only takes a few minutes to take it, and it will actually give you a really good feel with whether or not, to what extent, you're lying to yourself.
And if we were to pull up that website, what would it have? How many questions?
I think there may be 20.
20 questions.
Truthheals.com. And you can take it periodically, because the lies we tell ourselves vary. You know, they might be to one degree this week and much better a month from now.
But don't we all have, at the moment, consciousness of the lie? I mean, I'm sure you, me, Jeremy, Jonna, who's with us today, I'm sure we can locate it, that there's a lie even today.
Oh, but, or several.
Or several today. Mm-hmm. And don't you think, to me, in my own advantage, I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror and I look at that in particular, and I'm looking for that because I at least want to acknowledge its existence rather than hide it from myself.
Well, that's because of all your knowledge and training and experience. You know what happens if you ignore it.
I get stagnant.
Right. Yeah, right? So I want to know, too.
And I want to know because I don't want it to be controlling me.
Right.
I don't want it running me from behind me with this little nerdy thing it develops. You know, if you think about it, you hide a secret from yourself. You try to deny something. It turns into a little piece of substance. That substance now takes control of your life. It's like chalk on a blackboard.
It's like just the other day in an interview, I said that cancer is nothing more than a part of ourselves. It's forgotten who it is. And that's just a different way of saying the same thing you're saying
right now. That's quite an image.
It is, isn't it?
Cancer is a part of ourselves that has forgotten who it is.
It's what I do with people is I help them reunite those parts of themselves that they've accidentally separated from. It's just a part of ourselves that we thought was unlovable or we thought wouldn't work in this relationship, so we're going to dispose of that part of ourselves. And when we bring it back and we reintegrate it into the whole of ourselves, we become whole.
Do you think, Deborah, because I think you're going to have an answer to this, and I'm sure it's a question you didn't expect, but I've got to, since you're such a good person, I think I'll hit you with one. Do you think that there is something about menopause that brings an opportunity for a person to sail through menopause without as many symptoms? Or is it the lies, which I suspect, and I think you're going to find it intriguing to consider, as you go through menopause, is it the lies that winds up in the extreme symptomatology that happens at that time?
Interesting question that I've actually not considered.
I know, that's why I asked.
Huh, that's really interesting.
Because you think about it. Look, menopause starts to happen. You lose your eggs, right? You say to yourself, a part of you is saying, I'm getting old. Another part of you says, I don't want to get old. Another part of you says, no, I'm not getting old. Another part of you says, I don't want to see I'm getting old. I'm going to buy a new house. I'm going to get a puppy.
Or get a new man,
right? And then it goes a little further, and you see your hair turning gray, and you're saying, oh, I'm getting unattractive. No, I'm not getting unattractive. I'm going to go get some Botox. See, and the reaction on the inside, whereas if you were somebody who weren't afraid of what was going on, maybe as you would see yourself, if you were willing to accept these things instead of have the lies, you could say to yourself, boy, I'm looking older.
Well, let me answer that, because as a postmenopausal woman, I have a little advantage over you here, having been through it myself.
Which is exactly why I asked you.
Yeah, here are my thoughts. What I've found working with literally thousands of women is that it's usually pretty physical in the sense that we become very separated from the earth. The earth is what really is keeping us all healthy. And if you just think about our lifestyles today, living on freeways, sitting under artificial lights, eating food that is devitalized, it's lost a lot of its vitality, living a life at a pace with the stresses that the modern woman has. The typical modern woman, she works and she has a family. She's trying to juggle all those balls in the air. This puts just too much stress on the endocrine system. So by the time she hits menopause, the glands that need to kick in hormones for her when her ovaries aren't producing them anymore, for example, her adrenal glands, they're tired. They can't. So my own experience with women is it's often very physical. And what they really need to do is reconnect to the source of their strength. And so what I do is I send them outside. I tell them that they need to sit with their back against a tree. As soon as the weather turns nice, walk barefoot out, you know, on grass or at the ocean. Do things that really reconnect them to the natural world.
No. Yes, great. I mean, wonderful. But there's a lie here. The lie here is not acknowledging that what's happening is you are getting older and you're changing.
Well, we can't acknowledge that. This is a youth-oriented culture, so
I know, but
you're asking. So of course, it's a lie.
Okay,
it's,
but now if I want you not to sit with your back against a tree, but to acknowledge what's really going on so you don't have to go out there and put your back against a tree, but you may say to yourself, now I know what's going on. I see the truth. I am getting a little older. I'm okay with getting older, but I'm going to wear makeup and try to still attract the younger people if I can, and I'll go out and sit with my back against the tree.
Well, and there's evidence from other cultures that supports what you're talking about. So, for example, in Japan, they don't actually have a word for menopause. And that's because women there, over 45, aren't experiencing the symptoms that they do here in the West. And you think about Japan, just think about still to this day the reverence they have for the elderly that, of course, we don't have. See, so you're making
so
a very
at that
good
now,
point.
That's brilliant, mm-hmm. Of course. I guess I'm saying I'm brilliant. Yes, uh-huh. Of course, because of the reverence for the elderly as you age. You're no longer being sent out onto the ice and being told we're done with you.
Uh-huh.
So I think menopause may be a Western narcissistic symptom.
So I'm
to call Christine Northrup.
Right, I'm agreeing with you because I think there is this profound. It's at a spiritual level. This mm-hmm. unhappiness mm-hmm. that Western women have because we don't feel like we matter. We don't feel like we have a place. And so there's this desperate need to try to look younger, and that's pretty hard to do.
You know, the interesting thing about it is men are not really very different, of course, because as they age, you know, they may not go through menopause, but they go through their own things.
Something pretty similar.
Pretty similar. And the same question is there, I no longer matter. And I was talking to someone who was over 70 years old, and he said to me the other day, you know, every time I walk down the street, I'm invisible. Nobody even looks at me. He said, they glance at me, but they decide never to look at me because I'm considered...
Because of his age.
Because I'm considered invisible. Very, very interesting. Not me. I honor the elderly. This is Armand DeMille with you with... we just wish we had more time. Don't we always wish, Jeremy, don't we always wish we had more time?
Absolutely, Armand.
I mean, this is just silly. We have to get to our
enough.
Programs. Yeah. Deborah King, you're a lovely guest. Thank you so much for here. Truth Heals is the name of the book. And the website is truthheals.com. Me, I'm thrilled. I will be back with you soon, my friends. If you want to hear today's program again or send it to a friend, you go to thepositivemind.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to armand@thepositivemind.com. Be back with you soon, my friends.
Oh, partigiano, portami via. Oh, bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, 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 partigiano, portami via.
This is listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, bringing you news, information, and programming meant to empower you. We need your support. If you go to our website, wbai.org, and press the donate button, For as little as $10 a month, you can become a sustaining member. You'll be making a tax-deductible contribution that helps us help you by bringing you Truth in Radio.
The California coast was shrouded in fog that 4th of July morning in 1952. 21 miles to the west on Catalina Island, a 34-year-old woman waded into the water and began swimming toward California, determined to be the first woman to do so. Her name was Florence Chadwick, and she had already been the first woman to swim the English Channel in both directions. The water was numbing cold that July morning, and the fog was so thick she could hardly see the boats in her own party. Millions were watching on national television. Several times, sharks, which had gotten too close, had to be driven away with rifles to protect the lone figure in the water. As the hours ticked off, she swam on. Fatigue had never been her big problem in these swims. It was the bone-chilling cold of the water. More than 15 hours later, numbed with the cold, she asked to be taken out. She couldn't go on. Her mother and her trainer alongside in a boat told her that they were near land. They urged her not to quit. But when she looked toward the California coast, all she could see was the dense fog. A few minutes later, at 15 hours and 55 minutes, she was taken out of the water. It was not until hours later, when her body began to thaw, that she felt the shock of failure. To a reporter, she blurted out, "Look, I'm not excusing myself, but if I could have seen land, I might have made it." She had been pulled out only a half mile from the California coast. Later, she was to reflect that she had been licked not by fatigue or even the cold. The fog alone had defeated her because it obscured her goal. It had blinded her reason, her eyes, her heart. It was the only time Florence Chadwick ever quit. 2 months later, she swam that same channel, and again fog obscured her view. But this time she swam with her faith intact. Somewhere behind that fog was land. Not only was she the first woman to swim the Catalina Channel, but she beat the men's record by more than 2 hours. Thank you.
Thank you.